AgriTalk is brought to you by Full Scale from Helena. Grow strong returns this season with breakthrough foliar nutrition from Full Scale at Reproduction. Today is a study of contrasts. On one hand, we're talking about one of the coldest late April outlooks ever. And on the other, we're talking details and outlook for two of the hottest markets in America. And no, I'm not talking about corn and soybeans.
Live from Cold Snap Part 2, Deep Freeze Revenge, via Farm Journal broadcast, this is AgriTalk. This morning we begin with a conversation with Machinery Pete Greg Peterson. Then we'll talk with Doug Hensley, president of Hertz Real Estate Services. And right after the news, Michael Clark from BAM WX. I'm handsome newsman Davis Michelson. Now here's the host of AgriTalk, Chip Lowry.
All right, Davis. Hey, thank you so much. 36 yeah, degrees. 36 degrees outside the bunker. And
this is all part of my plan.
Oh, is it? And within the next hour, we're supposed to have some snow.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This works out perfectly.
I don't like it. No. I don't like it. This is going to be no good for all the May apples that came up over the weekend out in the timber. Mm-hmm. It's going to be a problem for them.
Well, and for me, you know, I've outlined this plan before, but it's all working together. You know, I've got a camping trip planned the first week of May.
That's right. That's right.
And if it stays cold enough long enough,
right,
I just may have the campground to myself. Me and my handsome news dog.
And can you imagine the boomerang effect that is going to happen from this cold snap when it breaks, you might have the campground to yourself and it could be perfect.
Yes.
It could be absolutely
And
perfect.
The thing is, now this would be the icing on the cake because I'm going rock hunting. All right. Little amateur geology. Okay.
Yeah.
And what's really helpful for that is just a little bit of erosion in the area where I'm going. You want to, just wet it down a little bit.
Sure.
Maybe get some of those dry creek beds freshened up just a bit.
There you go.
You know? And when this weather flips, if the right front hits at the right time in the right place, maybe all signs point to treasures abounding. I'm very excited by all of this.
Don't find too much. I don't need you to come home financially, self-sufficient or anything like that. I just assume that you need a job when you get back from this camping trip.
Well, whether I find gold or pyrite, it'll be fool's gold either way.
Yeah. Right, right. Gotcha. All right, man. Hey, thanks for joining us today. Glad that you are here. I'm Chip. That's Davis.
Yes, sir.
We've got a great show lined up for you, and let's go ahead and get started with some news. What you got, bud?
Well, Chip, the Bank of England and the UK Treasury announced the joint creation of a central bank digital currency tax force to, quote, coordinate the exploration of a potential UK CBDC. British Finance Minister Rishi Sunak has told the Bank of England to look at the case for a new Britcoin, or central bank-backed digital currency, aimed at tackling some of the challenges posed by cryptocurrencies such as Bitcoin. China has also begun exploring a move to a digital currency, although economists and Chinese officials say that move will not threaten the supremacy of the U.S. dollar. So at least we've got the Chinese saying, don't worry about it. Our digital currency is not a threat.
You know,
that's not scary.
We thought we were pretty much foolproof here at AgriTalk until last week when it comes to technology. We just felt like everything was on, you know, hey,
right,
try to take us down.
Right. Yeah.
We had some major issues last week. And what makes us think that going digital like this is where's the security in it all? I don't understand.
Nope.
I don't understand. Anyway.
Well, President Joe Biden's announcement to name USDA's senior climate advisor to an undersecretary post that oversees farm and conservation programs will be key regarding ag-related climate programs ahead. Now, Bonnie has pushed for creating a carbon bank with USDA funding to pay agricultural landowners a fixed price per ton of carbon emissions they reduce by using climate smart practices. Right. The payments would serve as incentives for farmers, ranchers, and foresters to adopt or expand their use of these land management practices. So expand their use. Those are for the guys that have already been doing this, it sounds like.
I don't think so because they're going to get paid per ton of carbon emissions they reduce.
Okay.
So if you've already reduced, if you want in on the payment, you're going to have to reduce further. At least that's how I take it for the comments from Robert Bonney. We're learning. We're learning that for the first time, a company is offering some of those legacy payments. We're digging into it. We'll have the details for you, hopefully, by the end of the week.
Well, Chip, the Biden administration plans to announce billions of dollars more in aid to help developing nations adapt to global warming and embrace clean energy, according to people familiar with the matter. The finance plan is part of a rush of actions as the administration seeks to prove to the world that the U.S. is back in the global fight against climate change. Now, China is mentioning some of its less advanced solutions to a carbon neutral future as it commits to tackling climate change in tandem with the Biden administration. The two countries, which combine to generate nearly 40% of the world's total emissions of greenhouse gases, agreed to reduce their own emissions while helping other countries make the transition to low-carbon energy. I guess we can assume it went well with climate czar Kerry over in Shanghai.
Well, okay. I guess we can make that assumption. But this is they're accelerating the efforts, and it will be interesting to see if some of the efforts that we're talking about at USDA, if they even qualify for any credit under the Paris Accord.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
That hasn't been settled. It's interesting stuff. All right, Davis. Thanks, buddy. Let's bring in Michael Clark. He is with BAMWX.com. How you doing, Michael?
Good, Chip. How are you?
I'm well. It's 36 degrees. I'm going to be getting some snow here before too long. So I've been better. Yeah, I'll just say it.
It's pretty ridiculous out there.
Absolutely. Okay, this has been persistent. You've been talking about it for a couple of weeks, and it looks like we've got the biggest departure from normal that we've seen in April, at least, still to come, huh?
Yeah. Wednesday morning will be record-breaking cold for probably over 12 states in the central U.S., basically almost all the states in the Ag Belt. As a hard freeze will grip the area Wednesday morning. And then you'll even have record low maximums for highs on Wednesday. You won't be able to, won't be able to warm up either. So it's definitely going to be the coldest shot of air this late in April in history, for sure.
Wow. How far? Jeez. Yep. How far south?
All the way down into, in terms of record cold, all the way down into north central Texas. So, in terms of a freeze, you're looking at, again, basically all of Kansas, Missouri. I had a customer reach out this morning, asked if the low is right, that it's going to be 18 tonight in western Kansas. And that is correct. It's going to be 18 degrees there tonight. So, again, almost everybody getting in on the cold.
Yeah. So it's just a question of how far along the wheat is on how much damage is going to be done. So there's going to be damage. It just depends on whether or not it's going to be permanent or not. Record cold temps. Wow, Michael.
Yep.
Give us a break by the first week of May, okay?
I'll try to. I'll work on that for you.
Perfect. Thanks, buddy. That's Michael Clark, BAMWX.com. We've got Greg Peterson, Machinery Pete, with the details of the latest auctions coming up next. Each year, there are billions of bushels of corn out there just waiting to solve the world's most pressing issues like climate change. Demand fluctuates. Exports are unreliable. So how do we use all that corn right here at home to change the world? POET is working hard to ensure reliable domestic demand for ever-increasing corn yields. Not only is the need for clean bio products made from your crops continuing to increase, nationwide adoption of E15 is also on the horizon. This would increase the amount of bioethanol in the nation's fuel supply from 10 to 15%, resulting in a market of almost 2 billion bushels of new corn demand each year. That's 2 billion really good reasons to support biofuels. It's time for farmers and policymakers to unify around E15. Bioethanol is the key to successful agriculture, and successful agriculture can change the world. Learn more at poet.com/ag.
Machine Repeat here, folks. This segment of AgriTalk brought to you by our friends at Dakota Ag Innovations, makers of Dakota Shine, the best way I've seen to fix faded paint. Go to dakotashine.com, call 888-996-7801.
A couple things, Chip.
Yes, Davis.
Welcome back to AgriTalk. Thing one. I mowed on Saturday.
Yeah.
And I was almost at the point to where I was going to go full bare-chested. I was going to shed the top layer. The sun was shining. It was warm. It was beautiful.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, the widow across the street, and she had her daughter over, and let's not attract unnecessary attention. Thing two, in order to retrieve the mower, right? I had it stored out at the farm. Out in the big shed. He's in the big shed. Yep. Yep. Someone had parked a John Deere 2020 in front of that mower, and I couldn't get it out. I had to drive a tractor this weekend. I felt like a real farmer.
I went about
20 feet forward and then 20 feet in reverse, but I drove a tractor.
Listen to you. Wow. Wow. Big time. You're a BTO, baby. BTO.
Well, you know, I don't like to brag.
That's fantastic. I did a little maintenance on some pasture ground this weekend, too.
Attaboy. Attaboy.
Yeah. Yeah. Get out and get things started all on an equal footing. It's going to be all right.
Got to get that done ahead of the snow, apparently.
Ahead of the snow. Right. Yeah. Right.
Well, there's a bucket on that 2020, so we're ready, you know.
Okay. Greg Peterson, Machine Repeat, joins us now. How you doing, Greg?
Hey, I'm doing pretty well, Chip. I do have a mower story of my own from this weekend.
Yeah?
A little different take now. Of course, I live in Rochester here, and our neighbor, three houses down this week, they have one of those mowers that's a little robot mower. It looks like a Roomba running out around the backyard, and the thing runs like 24/7. It's completely random, and we're sitting there figuring, how the heck does it get all the grass? It's just unbelievable, but there's people around watching it, and something different anyway. I'd never seen one before.
Does it make noise?
It's pretty quiet. I sort of think it's kind of a dull green color. I'm sort of thinking they should have made it a little more zippy looking. Put some lightning bolts on the side or something while you're at it. But I don't know. We'll be seeing how it does this summer. We'll see.
Excellent. Good stuff. Good stuff. Keep us updated on that. And let's get updated on what's going on in the world of used machinery with Pete's Pick of the Week. What you got?
Yeah, we're going deep south this week for Pick of the Week, guys. The Saturday in South Carolina, it was a 1997 John Deere 8100 mechanical front tractor. Just over 2,000 hours on it, one owner. It looked okay, but, I mean, you can tell the difference between an Iowa or Minnesota tractor, Illinois versus South Carolina, that sun and the heat and the oof. But anyway, this thing sold for $84,000, and that's the second highest auction price I've seen on an 8100 in 7.5 years.
Wow.
A lot of discussion about it this weekend. And, again, I share that because it's indicative of the used market now when we see very strong pricing coming out of the deep south like that. Over the 30 years I've been doing this, it just means that the market is very heated. So now 84,000 in South Carolina. And actually on Friday over in Alta, Iowa, our friends at the Iowa Auction Group sold a John Deere 8100 that was a 96 model, very nice, $3,458. That came in at $73,500. So a couple strong prices there on 8100s the last couple days.
All right. So why? Why the 8100s?
Well, I think actually last week we might have been the pick of the week. Last week we talked about Chip, an 8200, out of Lincoln, Nebraska, the one that brought $110,500 bucks with 1,490 hours on it, all time record by I think it was like $22,000 bucks. So these John Deere 8000 series, I mean, they're made from the 95 to 99. So you're 20, 25 years old, like around that 200 horse, give or take. You're old enough. When nice ones show up with low hours, whether they're green, red, blue, orange, silver, white ones, whatever, the buyer demand is just through the roof right now. We had another example a little farther back on an 8000 series Deere. It was out in western Iowa in early February, but a John Deere 8400, 98 model, 4,033 hours on it, went for $100K, tied for the highest auction price in 9 years. So, again, this stuff is happening all over. But, again, when I see it come out of the deep south, that really means the market is hot.
Okay. You may not have any information on this, but I'm going to go ahead and ask you, do you know where that tractor headed? I mean, did it come to the Midwest or did it stay in the South? Any idea?
I don't know that yet. Rebel Auction Company down there out of South Carolina had the sale. That would be interesting. More often, we have been hearing anecdotally that those type tractors, the low-hourd ones, when they show up down south, they are pulling in more buyers from U.S., not only U.S., but Canada. Because it's just hard to find a 2,000-hour 8100. Yep. So, yeah, it could be headed north. That very well could be.
Yeah, that's the reason I was asking it. I mean, with the way that obviously you can be anywhere, right, and go to one of these auctions now, it wouldn't surprise me at all if that tractor isn't coming to Iowa or Illinois.
Yep. Yeah, and the amount of pictures, and you're right, the whole online bidding thing this last year with COVID has just ramped up, just huge. So, yeah, I'll see if I can find out where that 8100 is headed. That would be interesting to know.
Okay, all right, very cool. So you were pretty busy on social media over the weekend too, weren't you?
Yeah, always have fun out there, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube. Thanks for following, folks. A couple I want to share from yesterday on Twitter. First off, Tyler Montgomery from Kansas started a thread. He posted a picture of an old dealer decal off a tractor. And this particular one was for Thomas Implement Company back when they used to be a John Deere dealer in, I think, Cimarron, Kansas. And these old decals, there's just a look to them. There was creativity. So anyway, we shared that on our Facebook page, and I just asked people, hey, do you have any favorites of your tractors you have? You purchased, and they have the old decals, and we got I think 82 responses on it. If you want to have fun, folks, just go to Machine Repeat Facebook page, check that out. Someone even posted a picture, Chip, of my dad's old dealership, Jacobson Peterson, from way back in the 70s, of an old salt shaker. So it's a lot of history there for sure. It's fun.
Wow, cool, dude, very cool.
So that was yesterday. Then there were two other Twitter posts I shared. One was from Ireland. There's a Twitter account. If you want to have fun, folks, and if you have Irish blood in you, follow Ireland's Farmers. It's a great Twitter account, and what they do is they give the reins every week to a different Irish farmer, and they just talk about their farm. So last week it was a dairy farmer, and she posted videos Monday through Friday, and just cool to hear their reality over there. She was talking about selling 10 calves, and people came to buy them. They got visiting and they forgot one calf when they were loading them up. So just good stuff. Now the third post that I shared, I know the state of Iowa is a rich history of women's basketball.
Yeah, absolutely.
So one of our Twitter followers, Carly Martin, who I think Carly works in ag marketing in eastern Iowa, but she was on vacation in Florida, and Carly was a very good high school basketball player in the state of Iowa years ago. And it's unbelievable. Go check it out, folks. It's on Machine Repeat Twitter. I shared it. Carly met another gal from Iowa, another farm girl, and they were playing pickup basketball against two minor league players for the Tampa Bay Rays, a professional baseball team. And they just schooled them. These Iowa farm girls make six buckets in a row. They're hitting from the outside. They're taking it to the hoop. It's just fantastic. And they're playing in flip-flops. It was just a cool video. Carly's had a lot of great Twitter posts over the years. She shared one a couple years ago of her grandpa in a combine that was very heartwarming. So I just had to share that one. That was fun. Shout out to Carly for that.
Very cool. Very cool, dude. Hey, what's coming up this week?
This week, our friends at the Steffes Group, steffesgroup.com. Check it out, folks. They got two farm land auctions tomorrow. And then on Wednesday, they have a estate sale for Mark Heck in Graceville, Minnesota. Some nice line of John Deere tractors. John Deere 4555 two-wheel drive, a 4650 two-wheel drive, a nice 4440. And if you're into snowmobiles, folks, Steffes Group has an online collector auction coming up. It ends May 6th. Steve Meyer. It is unbelievable. I shared it yesterday on our Twitter and Facebook. Check it out if you like vintage sleds. There are some pictures that are going to make you smile.
Very cool. Very cool. Good stuff, Greg. Thanks, buddy. I got to get on Twitter during the break here and check out those two Iowa farm girls taking it to professional athletes on the basketball court. Good stuff, man. Thanks. We'll talk to you next week.
Sounds good.
All right, Greg Peterson, Machinery Pete. We've got Doug Hensley from Hertz up next.
Time for Markets Now with the experts from Pro Farmer.
Joining us now, Pro Farmer editor Brian Grady. Beads, we've got some strength in corn and soybeans and wheat to start the week. What's behind this move?
Well, I'm going to start off with the corn market. We were bull spread overnight, but now the back end of new crop futures are leading us up, and December corn posted new highs. I think the entire complex is being supported by Safrina corn concerns out of Brazil, and just points to more demand for U.S. corn, whether it be old crop here over the next several months before we get to the end of the marketing year, or new crop once we get to the 21-22 marketing year. So that's the big news there in the corn market. On soybeans, haven't poked out to new highs yet. Bull spread with the front end of the market leading us up. The story there, I think, is that meal is trading solidly to the upside, and we got soy oil under pressure. And so soy oil has been the leader to the upside, and we're seeing corrective spread unwinding in the product market so far this morning.
Excellent. Okay. Short-term low or just a bounce in the hog market?
Well, we'll see by the end of today or a couple days out, but it sure does look promising from today's price perspective that maybe we just ran some corrective trade last week.
Right.
Strong gains here to kick off the week.
Yeah, some very strong gains in the lean hog market to kick off the week. We've got some pressure on the cattle complex, though.
Yeah, started out with a mixed tone. It looked like prices were trying to stabilize early on. But boy, that didn't last long, and we took out last week's lows, hit some sell stops, and here we are with sharp losses, and the feeder cattle are being pressured by strength in corn.
All right, that's Pro Farmer editor Brian Grady.
Opinions expressed on AgriTalk do not necessarily reflect the views of Farm Journal Broadcasting, affiliate stations, or sponsors.
It starts with a plan. That's why America's Conservation Ag Movement is inviting you to get your farm business ready for 2021 with a free Resource Stewardship Planning Guide. Get your free guide today at agweb.com/ACAM.
Welcome back to AgriTalk. I'm your host, Chip Flory. Got Davis Michelson with me.
Yellow.
And this is when I remind everyone that Davis wears many, many hats at mm-hmm. Farm Journal and Pro Farmer. And one of the hats that he wears is the editor of Landowner Newsletter. Puts the newsletter out once a month. And
that's right.
He was recently having a conversation with Doug Hensley, president of Hertz Farm Management, and we just kind of decided that it was time to get Doug on and have a conversation about what's going on in the land market. Doug, welcome back to AgriTalk. How you doing?
I'm doing well. How's it going, fellas?
Doing okay. Okay. Really All right, good. Davis. Yep. Let's let's get into it, buddy.
Well, Doug, as Chip said, you know, before we get too deep, it's been a while since we talked. How's biz?
Sure. Yeah, business has been really good. It's a situation where I think everybody that's involved in most parts of agriculture, you know, I was thinking back, we're feeling a little better today than what we were a year ago this time. I remember being on with you guys in, I think it was late March, early April a year ago, and wow, what an uncertain time that we were staring at that time. And, you know, this entire market complex, both commodities, the land market, machinery market, everything in agriculture has just made a turn for the positive, it seems like. And boy, it's a lot more fun to talk to people right now, isn't it, out in the countryside?
Yes, it certainly is. There is no question about that. No doubt.
And, you know, one of the things that you mentioned when we were talking the other day was what a difference commodity prices make in the general outlook and in your business.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of things that drive the land market. You know, commodity prices are a big one. Interest rates are a big one. Government policy is a big one. And it's not very often that we have all of the factors that pour into creating direction in the land market, that they all align. And that's what's happened over this past, really the past 6 months, as much as anything, starting in late August, early September of last year, when the commodity prices with the derecho went through. And that obviously caused a lot of uncertainty in the marketplace as to production for 2020. And we didn't finish the crop year as strongly as what we'd wanted to, because it got dry in a lot of places and the crop was short. And China was buying. And boy, the commodity price environment just turned on a dime. And we have just seen a tremendous amount of strength in commodities, which has positioned farmers and farmland investors. Just their posture is different today because they're more confident about the potential for earnings on farm. And when you add to that low interest rates, continued government support to agriculture, and the real limitation that we've dealt with the last year or so is we just haven't had enough farms to sell. And so all those things have come together. And again, this market has just been positioned to move higher because all those things have pointed positively in a price direction. And we've seen competition for farms that, you know, previously we had seen something like this back in 2012 and 2013. In 2012, you'll remember the drought situation over in Illinois in particular changed the commodity markets. And when we had $8 corn, holy smokes, the market was on fire then in a similar way. And, you know, we haven't seen strength in the countryside like what we're dealing with today for, you know, since then, frankly.
Yeah.
So, yeah, a lot of strength.
Yeah. If I could jump in here real quick, guys, who's, are farmers still the number one buyer of the farmland, or are the investors starting to show up, Doug?
Yeah. Great question. Investors have always played a role in the farmland market. And when we talk about the investor community, it's not some faraway thing. In a lot of cases, these are local business people who want to diversify their investments. And so when we use the term investors, it's not always, you know, some big corporation a long ways away. Oftentimes, it's very successful local business people that understand the value and the performance that farms have delivered over the decades. And so when we use investors, there's different types. There are the institutional type of investors that play in the farmland markets across all of the Midwest and really all across the world. But farmers, if you look at the farmland surveys, fellas, you're going to see coming out of Iowa State or University of Illinois or wherever the data comes from, you're going to see that out of every 10 farms that are sold, 7 of them are still purchased by farmers.
And those
statistics vary a little bit year to year, but by and large, farmers are still the lion's share of buyers. Depending on the state, depending on the market conditions, investors will make up the balance. And, you know, that local investor is the type of buyer that makes up own 15 to 20% of the market, give or take, in a year. And then the institutional players are the ones that make up 5 to 10%, depending on the market that you're in. And so, investors today are paying attention to farmland because of its performance. When they look at the stock market and, you know, the roller coaster that we've been on the last year, investors don't love roller coasters. They love consistency. And it's a situation that farmland has been consistent over time. You understand what you're dealing with from a cash on cash return every year. Plus you hope that the asset will continue to appreciate over time, which farmland has done traditionally over the long term. And so, yeah, that's kind of the investor appetite is real, but don't mistake, farmers still buy the vast majority of farms that are available on the market.
Yep.
Well, and even with that in mind, let's focus in on that investor, that non-farmer investor who purchases farmland. Doug, it's my understanding they're not trading in their loafers for work boots. They're not going out and buying tractors and planning to farm the land themselves in probably, 99% of those purchases. So we're looking at a rental situation here. Do you notice any trends with rental arrangements regarding these non-farm investors as far as lease rates go?
Yeah. So, any time we have a market movement like we've had in the commodities, you're going to see some movement in the rental markets as well. And, for folks that negotiated their leases early in the fall last year, they locked in, if you were a cash rent lease, you locked in maybe what was a little bit light compared to what was today, because 450 corn looked pretty good. And now we're staring at, $5 to $6 corn. And so if we were negotiating those leases today, it would probably be a little stronger. But the vast majority of investors coming into the market, they don't like roller coasters. They like some level of certainty. So a lot of investors do look at cash leases as the most stable approach, because they know what they're going to get. And, coming into the 2021 crop year, as I mentioned, it was really a function of timing for how strong those leases were. If an investor bought a farm after the first of the year and closed on it and it didn't have a lease on it, they probably benefited by not having that lease negotiated, because crop prices were stronger here in the first quarter of 2021 than they were in the third and fourth quarter of 2020. So they're going to benefit. The other side of it that we see, though, and I don't want to tell everybody that cash leases are the only way that they happen, because they're not. There's lots of custom operation, that happens with investors. The thing about a custom operation from an investor's perspective is that they're going to get exactly what they deserve. If they're taking all the risk, essentially, and a lot of investors have said, I can absorb that so long as I have a reasonable understanding as to where the commodity markets are and where my input costs are going to be. Mm-hmm. And there's still some investors out there that will look at share leases. Is it a traditional 50-50 share lease that was so common 20 or 30 years ago? Probably not. Mm-hmm. But there are a lot of investors that will look at share, some type of flex lease that maybe there's a base cash rent, and they want to see their tenants succeed if they're working with a tenant, because most investors that we deal with, they want, this is a long-term thing for them. They want to have long-term relationships with farm operators. They want to work with people that are going to make their farms better, that are, conservation minded and are doing the right thing as it relates to the farm and environment. So, I think everybody, the investor word is kind of a dirty word sometimes to folks out in the countryside. And it shouldn't be, because these folks, a lot of them live in the local communities, and a lot of them really approach agriculture from a very positive perspective. And frankly, the investor community creates a lot of liquidity for farmland, and it's important. They play an important role in the farmland market.
Yeah.
And it's nothing new, right? To have non-farm investors hop into the farm markets. Right.
It's not new. They have participated in the farm markets for a long, long time. You bet.
Yep. Yep. So if you are someone that is interested in leasing ground, it's time to step up your game here too. You know, you don't just make a phone call and say, listen, I'd like to rent that piece of ground. You better show up with a portfolio of what your long-term plan is with that piece of ground if you're even going to get into the conversation with a lot of these landowners, and especially the guys that are investing in farmland, because they want to see their potential returns increase over time. Doug, it's good to talk with you again. Thank you, buddy.
Thanks, fellas. Always good to be
Thanks,
with you.
Thanks, Doug.
Appreciate the opportunity to visit.
You bet. That's Doug Hensley, president of Hertz Farm Management. Davis and I will be back in a moment.
AgriTalk is brought to you by America's Conservation Ag Movement, a national partnership to help farmers scale conservation for their businesses, the environment, and their communities. To learn more, visit agweb.com/ACAM.
Welcome back to AgriTalk. I'm your host, Chip Flory. Got Davis Michelson with me.
You bet.
Yeah. We're looking at two very, very contrasting scenarios today. I mean, this weather forecast is as cold as it's ever been for this time of the year. And then we've got those two mm-hmm. markets that we got into, the land market and the equipment yeah. market, the used equipment market, which are as – I don't know if you can call the land market as hot as it's ever been, because you go back to that time that Doug mentioned, that 2012-2013 time period, when right. we were seeing some 20,000 plus per acre numbers coming out of Northwest Iowa. And, you know, it wasn't just the promise of strong returns that supported the land market at that time. The hog industry was going through major expansion. Mm-hmm. Northwest Iowa was the hot spot for that expansion, and guys needed ground for manure management.
Yep.
And the manure management plans contributed to the strength that we saw in that livestock intensive area up in Northwest Iowa back in 12-13. And mm-hmm. heck, it carried into 14, dude. So yep. there's a lot at play in these markets. We might be missing that one, at least for now, as far as having a major impact on helping that land market move to the upside. But man,
well,
Doug just laid it out.
He really did.
There's always competition for that ground, and when you got low interest rates and the desire to be able to stand on something that you've invested in, mm-hmm. it's really important.
Yeah, and the other thing to keep in mind is in the farmland market, whether it's a farmer, whether it's an investor, whoever it is, typically this is not hot money. You know what we call that hot money that's going to move from here to
yes.
there quickly and respond very, very quickly. This is a long-term asset, and I think that maybe needs to be reflected just because of the nature of the investments.
Point.
Of the investment grade of, you know, I think that's probably reflected in the volatility, which yes is there, mm-hmm. but logically would take a little while longer to build. And so the up moves maybe take, rather than, you know, in the futures market, we can see a parabolic move in a couple of days
yeah.
that'll bend your brain. Whereas the same ground might be covered in the farmland market over a year or 2 years or 3 years. So and I think there's still time yet. You know, the other thing that, and this is why I reached out to him too, because, and he highlighted, you know, that sometimes there's kind of some furrowed brows when it comes to, investors moving in on the farmland market.
Yep.
But I mean, it's a reality right now. I mean, Ted Turner
sure.
has got like 2 million acres of ranch land.
Yeah,
Bill Gates, 242,000 acres. Even Jeff Bezos, apparently, I read, is building a land portfolio in West Texas.
Yeah, but that's on the moon. Bezos is buying ground on the moon.
Yeah.
It's Texas?
Yeah, Texas. West Texas. Which, yeah, depending on where you're at in West Texas, can seem a little bit like the face of the moon
yeah.
from what I hear. That's right. But there's, you know, there are others. And in fact, in Landowner this month, I'm working on a story of an Illinois billionaire, dude who owns the Jacksonville Jaguars and a UK soccer team, a football team over there, they call it, a soccer team. This is big time money that's starting to settle in to the agricultural land markets. And I think it's probably something we need to get used to.
Right. Okay. We need to pay close attention to what's going on with this wheat market as well. Because of the cold temperatures that are going to get deep into HRW country and the potential for some damage to that winter wheat crop over there. Now, I believe it was 1997. We had a mid-April freeze. All right.
Okay.
Now let me read to you. This is from the ERS, the Economic Research Service at USDA. It says weather conditions were extremely favorable during the winter wheat growing season, even after that freeze, with the exception of a mid-April freeze that hit portions of Texas, Oklahoma, and Kansas. Although many fields sustained considerable damage from the mid-April freeze, especially where there was no snow cover for protection, weather after the freeze was nearly ideal for the wheat plants to recover. Consequently, yields and harvested areas were record highs. Dude, we were losing our mind, our collective minds, over how much damage was done to that 1997 wheat crop. There were people out there on a daily basis trying to do assessments over just how much damage was done to the crop. And after that, it stayed cool. It stayed at least normal rainfall. But it stayed cool, and it gave, and the crop had moisture. And when everything was said and done, we got to the end of the year, and we had record yields even coming out of Kansas.
Right.
And it was a stunner, an absolute stunner to the market.
I read from World Weather Inc. that their belief is that while, yes, there may be some vegetative damage, some, you know, it might make it ugly for a little while. The potential for recovery is there, but I haven't heard anybody talking about a cool, wet summer. I'll just throw that out there. If we're going to be talking the recovery period, I don't know if it's there.
So if we do make this, you know, see that boomerang effect where we go from a period of cooler than normal to warmer than normal, that is like exactly what a freeze damage or a crop that is damaged by a mid-April freeze does not want to see. You want to see some cool temperatures and give it plenty of moisture to keep that thing limping along. But it's amazing what the retillering of that wheat crop did in 1997. So we're going to have to pay attention to that. All right. Thanks for listening this morning. You got to come back this afternoon. Jim Bauer, Bauer Trading, right here on AgriTalk.